The Beatniks.
Upbeat, downbeat, offbeat, heartbeat. Buried in a time capsule, blasted into orbit around Venus, our queen of love, honored on every launching pad of Venice West. Look down, Walt Whitman. I wear my hat as I please.
There was a time in America when one referred to being either upbeat or downbeat, or even offbeat. But today, one can be just beat. Or as San Francisco newspaperman Herb Kane put it, a beatnik.
3 o'clock in the morning, you hear the trains coming in, and you're waiting to hop that train. And you get an idea through your mind if you're a poet, and you say, trains mourn your distance. And that gives you the impetus for a poem. And the day I left, known for great unknown, my train mourned its distance in an iron climate. As tonnage and crew hung suspended between whistle and rail. And the day I left, known for great unknown, my train shivered until a shocked air swallowed our masts. As we lanced the miles aside, swinging gates and lights, clearing away the clutter, rocketing through tunnels on gyroscopes and hoops, roll down the night with a long candle that searched and searched for home.
The beatniks, beat or beatific, the barbarians, insinuating themselves on the American scene, marching bearded and sandaled, lovingly called holy by some, despised by others as devils. Men and women on the road, always on the road, whether moving or standing still, speaking and writing in a language they call secret, a language appropriating the best and the worst from Gertrude Stein to the road-weary Negro jazz musician, a bop hipster lingo that can sound at one and the same time like the repetitious mystic rose is a rose is a rose, to the subterranean gurgling of a nocturnal jazz musician digging the scene. These are the beatniks. Men and women who profess to scoff at society's ways and mores, whose spokesmen insist are on a wild toboggan ride to the future, whose words and attitudes, they say, are turning inside out the values of today.
Born like a veritable living prince, with small, pink, rectangular feet, and a disposition to hair. I stand under the blazing moon and wonder at the disappearance of all holy things from this once so promising world. Please me to be told that at 7 tomorrow morning an angel of justice will appear and that he will clean up people's messes for them. Their bloody snouts in it.
This is Sidney Omar inviting you to join us from Columbia Square as KNX probes the phenomenon of the beatnik, if not the newest, certainly the most frantic aspect of American bohemia, how it looks from the inside.
Table here at the gas house on the ocean front in Venice West. The gas house is a workshop for artists and poets, musicians, painters, sculptors, and normally admits the general public on certain specified evenings for what the police department here has called entertainment. We like to think of it as transforming the audience or bringing something like the message of art as a form of salvation. And among us here, for example, is Eric Nord, who is, by way of being the leader of this group, and he should tell us a little bit about the hassle we've been having here with the heat. Eric, what is the trouble here?
Well, really, the trouble, Larry, is it should not be any trouble at all. But there are a few people in the neighborhood here that we have not had the pleasure to have in our group, and who've been wondering what's been going on, who've been worried about us. And this worry has led them to call the police to investigate us. And whenever the police is called, they would rather sit in the police station and just push their buttons. They resent it.
And how it looks from the outside, from perhaps way out to the square world.
Well, I was associated with that group about a month and a half, and I found subversive activities such as drinking, terror goings on like with lesbians and homosexuals, and just subversive activities mostly.
A cat beatnik author Lawrence Lipton informs us is the swinging, sex-free, footloose, nocturnal, uninhibited, nonconformist genus of the human race. And Lipton, chronicler of the beat generation he claims is made up of holy barbarians, has gone back to the 1920s to officially name the world's original cat. And she turns out to be none other than Gertrude Stein. It was at her home and salon at number 27 Rue de Fleurus in Paris that the granite-faced, authoritative, paradoxical, enigmatic, Baltimore-born Gertrude looked at Ernest Hemingway and said of him and his fellow Americans, "You are all a lost generation." And if in the 1920s the restless young men and women of America were journeying to Paris to listen to Stein and argue the worth or lack of it of James Joyce and Picasso and Ezra Pound and Matisse, in the 30s they were back home, focusing their energies on new, old political orders, until the 40s, when they were on the road again and over the seas, the tabs being picked up by Uncle Sam, until they came home from the hot war to a cold one, and although they had won, they were beat. Lipton, author of the controversial, fast-selling The Holy Barbarians, explains it this way.
They have turned their backs entirely on political solutions, Mr. Omar. They are not at all interested in what Eisenhower is going to do with the world, or what... Well, I remember one of them said to me when I was on a visit in San Francisco, he said, laughingly, he said, just think of it, he said, here we were back from the World War II, and they were knocking themselves out, establishing the League of Nations, and Churchill was lowering or raising curtains all over the world in his Fulton speech. You remember when he spoke of the Iron Curtain? And on both sides of the curtain, the politicians were wrangling among themselves. And what were we doing? We were going back and forth across the country having one great time. We were digging America. We were digging jazz. We were loving and living. And we had turned our backs completely upon them. And it wasn't until 10 years later that they discovered us.
The world's original cat, Gertrude Stein, had perhaps put it another way.
Repeating then is in everyone. In everyone, their being and their feeling and their way of realizing everything and everyone comes out of them in repeating. More and more then, everyone comes to be clear to someone. Slowly, everyone in continuous repeating, to their minutest variation, comes to be clearer to someone. Everyone, whoever was or is or will be living, sometimes will be clearly realized by someone. Sometime there will be an ordered history of everyone. Slowly, every kind of one comes into ordered recognition. More and more than it is wonderful in living, the subtle variations coming clear into ordered recognition. coming to make everyone a part of some kind of them, some kind of men and women. Repeating then is in everyone. Everyone then comes sometime to be clearer to someone. Sometime there will be then an orderly history of everyone who ever was or is or will be living.
Lipton, the Boswell of the Beats, insists it is evident that she liberated language and literature from the diplomatic code of Geneva and also gave birth to the concentrated art of improvisation, the seed out of which was born jazz music, thus providing double insurance that the world was to be safe for future barbarians. And in the 1920s, in a lecture at Cambridge University relating to the writings of this first and foremost cat of them all, T.S. Eliot was to declare,
"Its rhythms have a peculiar hypnotic power not met with before. It has a kinship with the saxophone. If this is the future, then the future is, as it very likely is, of the barbarians."
And the future rushed on from this relatively slow rhythm to the mad pace of On the Road, the novel that in 1955 put author Jack Kerouac and the Beat Generation on the world map and the bestseller lists. Although responsible for coining of the term Beat Generation, Kerouac used those words only once in his book, doing so in this paragraph.
"The night was getting more and more frantic. I wish Dean and Carlo were there. Then I realized they'd be out of place and unhappy. They were like the man with the dungeon stone and the gloom rising from the underground. The sordid hipsters of America, a new beat generation that I was slowly joining."
Four years later, in 1959, Lawrence Lipton was to describe Venice, an outlying area of Los Angeles, as a haven for beats, doing so in his book, The Holy Barbarians, and thus dubbing the beatnik a holy barbarian, and claiming that Venice, or Venice West as he prefers it, was the newest in American Bohemia, and that the others were old and thus less desirable. That centers in New York's Greenwich Village and San Francisco's North Beach and areas in Chicago and Portland and Seattle and New Mexico, that these were now outdated, becoming more and more square, and that the place of the true beat was Venice. In his words, that horizontal, jerry-built slum by the sea. Through the years, through articles and essays and poems, he had sent out a clarion call, now made loud and clear through the controversial book. A clarion call ridiculed and disregarded by many, but heeded by others, young men and women ever willing and anxious to be heard, to join, to, as Lipton urged, to disaffiliate, to refuse to sing for your supper, to blow the whistle on the social lie. And what is the social lie?
The social lie is anything that any man or woman in our society does for his living, says for his safety, or asserts under coercion, which he knows to be false and untrue, a lie, in short.
And who is not a part of the social lie?
The persons who are strong enough and frank enough to disaffiliate themselves from the values of the society and will do no work that is antisocial, will say nothing in person, in private, or in public that they do not believe to be true. These people are not living the social life.
What kind of young men and women have answered the call? One is Warren Taylor, a 16-year-old Negro from Philadelphia, or as the Beats would call him, a spade cat. Taylor found that his decision provoked a disagreement with his mother.
She thinks the people that I would be hanging around with are queer, something like that. And I just don't understand how she means. I mean, I just don't believe the same way she does.
And why does Warren want to be beat?
Well, I'd like to live differently. I don't like to stay the same way that people are have been for a long time, or just because my folks have done it, that I have to do it too.
Does Warren find that being a Negro in the beat world is any different than in the world of the squares?
No, I think in the, as you say, beat world, there's quite a bit difference towards each other. I mean, people go for each other as if they were of one color, of one race. There isn't any difference, you know.
And in answering the call to Venice West, a call he heard from all the way back to Philadelphia, just how did he find his way to Lipton's Venice home?
Well, the first thing I did when I came, and we moved out here to California, I wanted to know my way around, so I hop on a bus every now and then and just travel to see what places are and things like that. And I came down to the beach and started walking out on the ocean front and went past places. I knew that they were, I found out then that they were the places of Bohemians. Of course, I didn't want to go in because you'd probably think I was square, and actually I didn't know what to do at the time. So I was reading the paper one night, and I happened to see a picture of Mr. Lipton sitting in front of his television set in his home, and they were looking at a program which Jack Linklater from CBS had put on television. They were, I think they were interviewing the king of the Bohemian world. And I saw the address in there. I was hoping there would be an address in the article itself, and it was. So I came down here one night and just came and saw Mr. Lipton. Like that he, well, of course he knew that I was a square. I guess he never saw me before. But he didn't treat me as if I was somebody who, you know, was a pure square or anything like that, and he didn't like me or anything like that. Just welcomed me with open arms.
In light of Warren's dispute with his mother over the beats, how does he think his mother would greet Lipton? Also with open arms?
She found out that he was a bohemian or a barbarian. I don't know what she'd do.
And another who answered the call and why, William Millette of Greenwich Village.
My impression is the great sincerity, the great finding of craftsmanship and finding of real values here, which wasn't in the Greenwich Village scene as I know of it as of a month ago.
And John Thomas of Baltimore.
Well, I couldn't make a living there. I had a beard and no one would hire me. I'd have starved to death if I'd stayed. I was running a UNIVAC computer and got canned because I decided to grow a beard.
And Julie Meredith, she's of Hollywood.
Well, it started with the beach, and I was made welcome here by the proprietors of the gas house as sort of a den mother, you might say, and just a resident artist. And then I found, looking around me, that there was a tremendous empathy. And poets aren't the only ones that feel this loneliness and this out of things and left aloneness. Artists of all kinds search. You can't search with anybody else. You have to search by yourself. So if anything, it's a sort of enforced loneliness while you're finding your way in your medium. But to my surprise and amazement, I found all around me people that were in exactly the same boat. I live here exactly as I do in my own house in Hollywood, making things and writing songs and little stories. And only I find that everybody around me is doing the same thing.
And 19-year-old vibrant Helene Lauder.
I'm looking for, sort of self-satisfaction and trying to find what I'd like to do as a vocation or a sort of square. Something I like to do that I could do longer, forever.
And in seeking this self-satisfaction, something to do forever, has she ever tried drugs, pot?
I had to try it once when I was employed at a certain place. They wanted us to know how to smell it, know what it looked like, etc. So we tried it. Didn't do anything.
And there is artist Fouad Magdalini, an introspective, brooding young man recently pictured in Life magazine, applying his art to Venice garbage cans.
Well, there's two types of beatniks, more or less. One whose life is art in some field or other, and whose life is sacred, and whose art is sacred, and the other whose life is nothing but laziness and, I'd say more or less like any type of hoodlums that had no purpose in life.
And what gives Magdalini's life a purpose?
Well, I'm fortunately gifted.
When did Magdalini discover he was gifted?
About 3 years ago, I was in a hospital. I had an operation and kind of nerves, stomach. And I was drawing, and the doctor seen me drawing, and he was interested in art and told me that I was I was quite talented, that I should keep it up.
And does beat artist Magdalene desire recognition?
Well, I do desire recognition and sponsorship and art, because it's my life, and I can't be bothered with everyday hassles, and I have to devote 20 hours of a day to my work and 5 hours to sleep.
And a square question might be, how does Magdalene manage financially?
Well, people see that I'm constructive in many ways. I can do so many different things. And they ask me to do odd jobs for them, like paint houses, which I do. Paint garbage cans, I'll do that too. Mm-hmm. Even though I consider myself great.
One of the staunchest members of the Venice Group is Stuart Perkoff, a bearded, moody young man who claims his poetry is the answer to anything.
Children play among the roots of unkept trees. Stones that once were shrines are farmed into houses of terror. There are crowds everywhere, clustered and clotted along the sides of the huge buildings, massing quietly in the streets. They turn their impassive faces towards the sky, their eyes empty of color and love, their mouths set and rigid, their scrubbed skins glistening in the pale sunlight. No heads turn. None seek to look upon, speak to any others. There is an absence of warmth. But quietly, seemingly unheeded, a whisper travels its course slowly through the crowds, speaking over and over to the unmoving faces. There was once a day set aside for spitting on the king.
The sounder of the clarion call, Lawrence Lipton, a short, balding, bespectacled, open-faced, cap-wearing man, defined beat terms and attitudes toward work.
Their attitude towards work is that of the eternal vagabond. The beatnik attitude towards work is as old as mankind. There have always been two kinds of people in the world. Those who regarded work as a necessary evil, and those who regarded it as a virtue and a good. I might remark in passing that those who regard it as a virtue and a good are chiefly among those who do the least work. That is to say, the owners of property, those who clip coupons, those who occupy palaces and go to watering places and work 1 hour a day and 2 months in the year. They are the ones who make a virtue of labor.
The beat attitude toward money.
Money, too, is a necessary evil to them, like work.
The beat attitude toward art.
Their life. They make a life of it. Art is their religion.
The beat attitude toward success.
They'll have no part of it.
The beat attitude toward family.
I think that they pity their elders, just as they pity the squares.
The beat attitude toward religion.
Religion, so far as the organized churches are concerned, is a fraud and a deception.
And Lipton, as he defined rules and regulations, must conformities for nonconformists, utilized his genius in the field of publicity. Before he gave up what he terms the rat race to become beat, the 56-year-old Lipton drew a top salary in the 1930s as head of publicity for Fox Theaters in New York. And he remembers the principles of this non-beat profession well enough to convince the most hardened skeptic that should he ever decide to turn non-beat, he could grace the offices of the plushest of Madison Avenue suites. From New York to Hollywood, Venice West and the Beat and the Holy Barbarians have become news in Time and Life and Newsweek and The Reporter, in newspapers, on radio and television, in the Sunday supplements, from the erudite to the strange world of the soap opera. Venice West has become a byword, as we hear in this excerpt from a recent segment in the life and loves of the indestructible Helen Trent.
Thank you.
Now, CBS Radio presents The Romance of Helen Trent.
Pete, we've gone all over this. I've got my little role in life, and I'll fill it until something terribly good comes along. So good, I can forget everything else.
I wish you'd come over to West Venice with me. Get a pad of your own. You'd make it, Kate. You're the freewheeling type they go for. They live.
They're all so dirty. I still like my tiled bath and that little touch of Dior.
And from soap opera emanating out of New York to motion pictures in Hollywood, as we hear now from KNX motion picture editor Joseph Layton.
It didn't take Hollywood producers long to discover that Beatnik is big box office. Few of them understand its philosophy, if philosophy it is, but they do know the word beatnik can get those barefoot squares away from the television set, into shoes and the neighborhood movie house. The possibilities of beatnik as story material didn't hit Hollywood with cataclysmic force. It gradually dawned on Hollywood. Perhaps its first appearance in films in any authentic form was in The Bachelor Party, where an unknown actress used a minor role as a springboard to stardom, and somebody took note that she played a beatnik, or something akin to a beatnik. Her name? Carolyn Jones. She had one great line. It was at a Greenwich Village party. A boy wants to kiss her, but she insists he first pledge his love. When he hesitates, Miss Jones closes her eyes, poises her lips, and says, "Say you love me. You don't have to mean it." That's when Hollywood began to look into the beatnik situation. Producers and writers got up from their mink-lined pads and began to prowl through beatnik hangouts, incognito, of course. The major studios, who had let the independents and the quick buck boys get the jump on them with money-making horror films, weren't about to let it happen again. One of the biggest studios in town, MGM, got its feet wet with a low-budget movie called The Beat Generation. And although all the returns are not yet in, the first reports are encouraging enough for them to invest rather heavily in a new beatnik book for transfer to the screen. The low-budget boys aren't sleeping in their pads either. Three of these men, Ben Schwab, William Woodfield, and Charles Block, just about to go into production with a horror movie called The Hypnotic Eye, took out what they felt was a form of box office insurance at the last minute. By writing a beatnik scene into the script and hiring Lawrence Lipton and Eric Nord to play the roles, says writer-producer Woodfield, as he greets Nord and Lipton when they drive into the studio in their Lincoln convertible, carefully removing their shoes before hoofing it to the set, says Woodfield admiringly, "How can we lose in this picture? With blood, sweat, and beards."
What, then, is the official beat attitude toward publicity? Mr. Lipton explains.
They regard publicity with loathing.
To this, Dr. Nathan Rickles, a psychiatrist of long professional standing, asserts...
I think it's another negative statement, which means nothing, because the few times that I have looked at television, on at least two or three occasions, I've seen Mr. Lipton on television. I'm sure nobody had a gun in his back telling him that he had to exploit himself or his movement. If they really want to disengage themselves from society, as they claim, I'm sure they could do it very quietly. Society would not miss them, and probably be much better off in many ways without the wild efforts that they have made for publicity. And that's all these kids are doing in their attitude. They are screaming, "Mother, come see what a bad boy I am. Take care of me. But whether I'm bad or good, whatever I am, please pay some attention to me."
Whatever the attitude may be, it is most certainly safe to say that publicity is the one commodity of the square world not lacking in Beatsville.
You are listening to The Beatniks, a special report by the KNX News Bureau from KNX CBS Radio in Los Angeles. Here again is Sidney Omar.
And the administrator of Venice is Lipton. From King Eric Nord down to the newest recruit trying desperately to dig the scene, the word is, refer the press, refer any inquiries to 20 Park Avenue, the ludicrous-sounding but correct Venice address for Mr. Lipton. Like any general and like any army, for that matter, Lipton and the Beats have had their problems with those who disaffiliate from the disaffiliates. Coastlines is the name of a Southern California literary magazine which has been publishing poems, short stories, articles, and other material by young and unknown as well as established writers for the past 5 years.
Lipton used to grace the pages of this publication along with beat poets Allen Ginsberg and Gregory Corso and others. Lipton's time has passed, however. Perhaps an editorial written in 1957 by Coastline's editor, Mel Weisbird, had something to do with it, for the editorial was titled The Merchant of Venice. The reference to Lipton was pointed, and here editor Weisbird reads from his own editorial, which characterized the publicity potential of both Lipton and Venice.
Once poetry becomes marketable, there is no reason why the business cannot expand indefinitely in the hands of a sharp publicist. In fact, it is amazing that no one has thought of it before. It is quite possible, like selling shoelaces, hairpins, filthy postcards, and inside stories to confidential. According to modern advertising technique, the first requirement is not to sell the product, especially, but to sell a way of life, a hermetic philosophy which cannot be altered except by administrative directive. And what would be more effective in the world of letters but to sell a package deal of dissent, a whole underground way of life, complete with heroes, to those who, perhaps gullible, are sincerely dissenting?
One of the heroes of the Beats is internationally renowned poet-author Kenneth Patchen, who, although idolized, has denied connection with any group and declares that the Beats need to be housebroken. Patchen pioneered the combination of poetry and jazz.
Not every man has the makings of a barber or even a tuner of one of those classy white wood pianos like they used to have in the river towns when Clint Burrows would bring down maybe 100 of the classiest girls from Big Fanny McCann's place on Peachtree Street and parade them naked through the town on Saturday night. And they're all singing hellfire hymns, sort of swinging from the bottoms up. I still don't know what point he was trying to make, but it sure made a sight people sort of remembered. That Clint was a strange man. He used to give me a whole dollar just for writing his name on a paper. When I was about 14 years old, why, Clint Burrows, he clumb up a big tree right smack in the middle of the courthouse park. And I don't think there was anybody important you can think of didn't try to talk him down out of that tree. But he didn't come down. Clint Burrows stayed up in that tree until he died. He left maybe $10-15 million to one of those brain factories up east. And the poor man couldn't even write his own name. Of course, a lot of people who can don't make a lot of difference. Either way, it don't make the birds sing. And it never made any bird stop singing. At least if it did, I never heard of it. In fact, I never heard of anything that ever made any bird stop singing.
Musician Walter Gross, composer of Tenderly, has this to say about such combinations and about beat music in general.
Your comparable strata in music to the beats in literature would be our extreme progressives. They give all sorts of funny titles to their music, and they are a group of individualists, and I must say that to me, the big difference between music as I knew it 15 years ago or when people danced, and when it was a delight to hear a good, clean, crisp band like Les Brown, to even hear wild music like Stan Kenton. Everything had a purpose. But you see, today, your progressive, your bopper, who corresponds to your beatnik in literature and in Venice, California, and all the places where they cuddle, these progressives are doing a very esoteric thing which eventually will ruin all public performance.
Get out your riot guns, citizens. Call out the militia. The poets are coming. Sound all the atomic sirens. The painters are making holy vessels out of the garbage cans of Venice West. I hear America singing. Bam! Roll on with Bam! Genie with the light brown hair can do. For a man who thinks for himself, why trade a headache or an upset stomach? Aloha, dos vidanio, au revoir, goodbye, later, man, later.
Perhaps the biggest squares, as far as the beatniks of Venice West are concerned, consist of those who have opposed the granting of an entertainment license for the Gas House, a bingo parlor which has been converted into a coffee house and which is owned by attorney Al Matthews. At the Gas House, whose walls are covered with modernistic beatnik paintings, young men and women congregate to read aloud their poetry and discuss everything from the A in astrology to the Z in Zen Buddhism. Leader of the opposition to the Gas House is A.S. Roberts of the Venice Civic Union, who apparently feels a little more goes on than just the reading of poetry.
I believe that out of six artists that this Gas House attracts 60 to 70 bum, what I call hoodnicks. I call them hoodnicks that roam the streets from 11:30 to 4 and 5 in the morning, such as breaking in open, vacant buildings and just raising their promotions in general all over the entire area.
But one who sides with the beatniks in their battle to open the Gas House is A.L. Wirin, Los Angeles Counsel for the American Civil Liberties Union.
The rights would seem to me and to the Civil Liberties Union to be involved in this case are the rights of persons who have been called beatniks, and I guess they call themselves beatniks sing songs, express views which are nonconformist views, views which are not acceptable to many persons generally and many persons in Venice.
A more lyrical or poetic plea, perhaps, is offered by beatnik artist Julie Meredith, who describes herself as the den mother of the Gas House.
Oh, boy. Oh, it befell in Venice West, in Venice by the sea. The Gas House came to make a scene of love and poetry, of love and artistry. The Civic Union did not agree. How wicked poets are, how wicked poets are. Their writing is out too far. The crime of modern painting we'll not bother to discuss. We hate the holy barbarian. He's different from us. He's different from us. That's why we make this fuss. Court the muse and let our painters reign, and let the ballad makers wail their merry folk refrain, their merry folk refrain. Let us open up again. Good citizens of Venice West, don't bug us, don't be mean. The Gas House is the place we need to make our swinging scene.
With the emergence of the beatnik phenomenon, the coffee house has sprung up across the nation. Part of the scene, the swinging scene, as the Beats would have it, the coffee house is certainly part of that scene, and attorney Al Matthews of Los Angeles, owner of the controversial Gas House, gives his views.
As I've noticed through history, that every breakthrough of new thought is first considered criminal. For instance, when the Christians came to Rome, their conduct was considered criminal. At least there was an attempt to suppress them. When six washerwomen in England tried to get together to get a little higher wages, they were charged with conspiracy. Every time you have a movement in society that people haven't seen before, they have a tendency to put down something that they don't understand. And I believe some of these people in Venice who've just heard vaguely about the Beats think that there's something wrong. When you pin them down, they can't show that these people have committed any particular crime. Just that they're doing things differently. Just that they have refused to do some of the things that other people do almost automatically.
Wherever, from New York to San Francisco to Venice to the chic Sunset Strip, there are coffee houses and people who patronize them. Desiree Constance, a young Hollywood actress, recently arrived from New York, tells why she frequents one of the Sunset Strip coffee houses.
Yes, I frequent the coffee houses on Sunset Boulevard, but I don't think this makes me either beat or non-beat. I go there to see and to be seen and to talk to other actors and actresses. It's a sort of meeting place, a clearinghouse, so to speak. You see, when an actress is trying to establish herself in the very beginning out here in Hollywood, it's not only the ability to act, but also knowing the business and becoming familiar with the people that are in the business. And this is what we discuss when we go there. And when you walk in, if you see someone that you know, you can go up to them or you can table hop, and it isn't considered in bad taste. And as for the coffee houses that the real beatniks go to in Venice West, I don't know about them because I've never been there.
But if Desiree had been there, she might have walked into a discussion on any number of subjects, such as this one at the Gas House, on the beat attitude towards sex, being led by leader Lipton.
The members of the community here, especially among some of the older women that have come around and seen, they looked into the windows, they peep in, you know. It's a funny thing about squares, they're all peeping Toms, and it seems to me. They're curious, and one of them said, why, bongo drums keep us up until all hours of the night, and they go around the streets making practically free love on the sidewalks and things of that sort. I don't think they understand what our attitude towards love and sex is. What difference is there really between our attitudes and the attitudes of the square? Julie, what do you think?
I'm just astonished that they should be shocked at a peck on the cheek on the street here by one of us to one of our friends. It never gave me any concern. It doesn't now. I'm just surprised that they're being shocked at something so casual and gentle. It wasn't... I'm sure the incidences referred to wouldn't have been noticed had it been by the people here in Venice. But simply because it's us, oh mercy, look what we're doing. Shame, shame. I suspect if we shook hands, there'd be something wicked about that, too.
Hey, Eric, what's been your experience of this?
Well, you see, that's one thing we've been put down for. They claim that we make free love here. But all they see is... through the window from across the street, they see somebody kissing. They may be kissing somebody goodbye, for all they know.
Or their husband or something.
Yeah. I mean, but it's happening in here.
I've seen more beautiful married love since I came into this place than ever. There's a difference right there. There's a particular artist, you know which one I mean.
Yeah.
Stu, the one that did the lovely painting of Eve.
Mm-hmm.
He and his wife have three lovely children, and they're expecting a fourth. And you never saw the such respect and such sweetness between two people. You'd think they had just met. There's a difference right there.
Yes, well, I've seen that. Of course, this is really a similarity between the square and the... Well, the difference
the
I'd like to...
The square marriage stultifies and gets sort of boring after a while, and they refer to the ball and chain in a sarcastic tone. You wouldn't catch Stu talking like that about his wife.
Yes, that may be so. But on the other hand, I've found that much that is, shall we say... unconventional sexual behavior is found in both places. Mm-hmm. The difference is that they are discreet, as they say about it. The squares like to use that word, discreet. It means, of course, they're hypocrites.
You mean they lie. That's what you mean.
Yes, that's right. That's part of the social lie, see? And whereas we are likely to be frank about it, you see, and honest and open, you see. This is the difference I can see.
Yeah, I'd like to tell one little story about this woman that owns the hotel. She was talking about all this free love and free sex going on. And I said, well, I think there's a man that owns your building. We talked to him, and as far as he's concerned, he likes what we're doing. And he said, if anybody that doesn't like what we're doing over in the hotel there, they can leave. And she says, well, he does not own the building. He just lives with me. And she called him, oh, my God, what did I
say? Elaine just dropped in. We're discussing the different attitudes towards sex on the part of the cats and the squares. What would you like to say about that? I mean, what is really the difference between our attitudes?
Between
cat and square.
Hepcat
and square.
Well, I'd say that Hepcat's opinions and viewpoints on sex are more healthy in a way. It's not so much sweat. And a square in sex, they're always, we'll say that movies, sexy movies, etc., are sort of a square production. So there's so much to do about sex that it's unhealthy, and it's just not cool.
Yeah, somebody.
It's just sex. They accept it as a natural thing and don't.
Like nobody talks about food all the time. You just have it.
Yeah.
Somebody said to me in these circles one day, he said, "Sex isn't something you talk about. It's something you do."
Sure.
All right, okay, now let's not talk about it. Let's do it.
And from coffee houses to where? Where are the beats going, if anywhere? Perhaps from coffee houses to hotels? That's the newest thing, you know, a hotel for beats at Venice, leased by attorney Al Matthews, yes, the same Matthews who is proprietor of the Gas House. And although Matthews owns it, or leases it, the spokesman, as usual, is Lawrence Lipton, who tells why a hotel for beatniks.
It's could better be described as a hotel for squares. It is the home, you might say, a monastic home for members of the Brotherhood of Holy Barbarians, and welcome to it are those who. Squares who wish to escape from the rat race.
And where next? From hotels to maybe special bookstores? Well, poet Lawrence Ferlinghetti has two such stores in San Francisco, and he's a successful publisher of beat poetry as well. But all is not beer and Skittles, or should we say, some of it's a drag man, as we hear now from Bob Handy, who used to own a beat bookstore on Hollywood Boulevard.
I did more or less cater to the so-called beat generation. I think I had the largest stock of quarterly magazines, stocked Grover's books, and just about anyone who came in and put their stuff on consignment, I welcomed with open arms. I wanted to be a little bit different. Well, being a little bit different, I lost quite a little bit. Not only the bookshop, but a wife, a happy home, a couple of dogs, and a few cats.
And once out of the pads and coffee houses and hotels and bookstores, what then? James Boyer May is editor of Trace, an international literary magazine, the guide and directory for so-called little magazines the world over. He is an eminent critic, author, and poet. He is neither beat, and he certainly is not square. His words carry the weight of years of background and experience.
I remember, it's a number of years ago now, not long after I had first met Mr. Lawrence Lipton. Larry really didn't know too much about modern poetry and knew practically none of the younger poets. And I sort of steered him to these people. I believe it was a party for Lawrence Spingarn's sister. Lawrence Spingarn also is a very important writer in our area. And at any rate, Zahn was there. I wasn't there. Zahn, by the way, is also a painter as well as a writer. And at the present time, and for quite some time, has been rather violent in his statements against what he calls the beat. But I asked Larry what he thought of Curtis after this evening. I think it was about 1954. And he said, oh, he said, I don't know what to think of him. He said, you know, he listened while lying on the floor. And he wears sandals and a beard. Now, lo and behold, now we find Mr. Lipton has adopted all these people and their sandals and beards and lying on the floor. Now, this is all the fashion. The undergraduates at our colleges and universities throughout the country are being influenced by this, and this perhaps is not too good an influence. And rather amazingly, it seems to me that they're able to produce work which is on a par or even better than the so-called prominent beats. In particular, Willard Moss of Wagner College, New York, organized a recent symposium for that school's literary quarterly, soliciting reactions to the beat from prominent persons here and abroad. He sent them the work of Allen Ginsberg, Gregory Corso, and Mr. Orlovsky, together with work of undergraduates at the school. And on the basis of their reading of this, these people wrote in. Sir Herbert Reed wrote, "Seen from Europe, the beats are indeed old hat. That is to say, not very original." Philip Robb wrote, "I have looked over this stuff, and it seems pretty vacuous to me." Marius Bewley wrote, "The beat writers stand for a deadly conformism to non-manners that is more stereotyped and obnoxious than that of any suburbanite and his station wagon. Beat conformity precludes any creative originality and ultimately amounts to a hatred of art. As a movement, beat poetry belongs to the history of publicity, not of literature."
Bob Kirsch is book editor for the Los Angeles Times, author of the novel In the Wrong Rain, and considered one of the better book reviewers in the nation.
My feeling is that until these people learn the English language, they should not be allowed to mangle it.
And for a final say, so we can really dig the scene, Lawrence Lipton sums up for us.
Well, I shall say it in the words of my poem, A Funky Blues, for all squares, creeps, and cornballs. Their arms are knives, their fingers all nails. When they try to make love, they hurt each other. When their lips close, smiling, it is like the maw of some poisonous flower closing. They torture themselves with shame and pride, with time clocks and unattainable ambitions. They get so they believe their own hired liars. They bug themselves with their own advertising slogans. They drag themselves over miles of broken glass and stone themselves with false confessions. They seem to be atoning everlastingly for some nameless, long-forgotten crime. If I knew what it was they had done, I would talk to God about it. I can't promise that I could get them off, but I'd feel duty-bound to use my influence. As it is, all I can do is feel sorry for them. And for this, they will never forgive me.
Well, what is the final answer? That, as Mr. Lipton himself might put it, must come later, man, later.
The Beatniks was a special report of the KNX News Bureau. It was reported and edited by Sidney Omar.